From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis will talk about Islamic State militants destroying significant artifacts in the Middle East, and Rebecca Cruz and I discuss the ongoing migrant crisis throughout Europe.
The Coast Guard in Greece just this past weekend said that there were 2,500 people that they rescued in the Mediterranean, and we're also seeing very, very tragic pictures and tragic stories.
Then I'm joined by Braulio Fernandez, a professor and literary critic at the University of the Andes in Chile. While everyone he went to school with studied Spanish literature, Braulio Fernandez gravitated towards something else.
In my case, it was a sign of rebellion, I think. I'm cool. I read John Donne.
Perspectives on international literature after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Joshua Landis and Rebecca Cruz. It's roundtable time, all three of us together. That's great. But Joshua, let's start with you. Big news this week out of Syria, ISIS destroyed another significant ancient site. Tell us about what's happening there. They've done this before. This continues to happen. Why? What's the whole point of this? And what are the implications and the consequences?
Well, the temple to Baal was blown up. This is an early Palmyran temple that to the god of Baal. It is pagan temple. ISIS said it was not going to blow up the ruins, but now they began to attack saints' shrines, and now they've attacked the most beautiful, the best preserved shrine. Now, Palmyra is a very big historic site. It is the jewel in the crown of Syrian archaeology. It's probably the best preserved Roman site anywhere. And this temple has all of the pillars. They just turned it into dust. If you look at the satellite photos now, it's just one big dusty flat thing. And that's the second one that they've blown up like this.
So there's obviously some ideology behind this. Kind of give us the context here of what they're trying to accomplish by reducing these shrines to dust.
They claim that this is getting rid of paganism and that there is a war. This is like the iconoclastic movement amongst the Byzantines and so forth. To destroy what is seen as bid'ah, innovations, and preaching to other gods, to make one god and to be monotheistic. Now, of course, they're doing it in a Hollywood version to get attention, just the way the cutting off of heads was done in spectacular fashion with orange suits in order to poke at the noses of the West. And this is done in the same way. It is ruining the prospects for people. Palmyra is a dusty little oasis city. Every bit of money that came to that city came because of tourism. They are destroying the livelihood of all these people that live there into the future. It's a devastating thing. It's very short-sighted. And of course, it's a product of the complete meltdown of Syria and Iraq.
And ISIS? I mean, is this some signal that they are grasping at straws here? I mean,
you'd like to think that this was the sort of last gasp, but unfortunately it isn't. It has become part of a propaganda ploy that's working. And we don't have really any evidence that ISIS is weaker today than it was a year ago when the United States began to bomb it. It has found a way to be a recruitment tool. And that's unfortunately, this radical actions is strengthening the movement so far. You would think that it would be the death knell and that in the long run, you know, many Muslims, of course, are horrified by this. But there is a underclass of people that are being recruited and young, you know, we've seen young people from the West going there in larger and larger numbers. So this is the, we don't know what to do about it right now.
All right. Well, Rebecca, let's turn to you. By extension, let's talk about the Middle East, because obviously we know that these Middle East conflicts, the one in Syria and elsewhere, have led to a significant humanitarian refugee crisis that's regularly in the news, and the images are very disturbing. But this week, truly disturbing news coming out of Central Europe, where so many hundreds of thousands of refugees have made it to Europe and are panicking there, creating a large panic there, trying to board trains to leave Budapest in this example this week, that it is just overflowing with these refugees, and the Hungarian authorities having to shut down the train station for some time. But we've seen boats full of individuals coming across the Mediterranean, bodies washing up on shore as they sink because they're overloaded. And now this incident in Budapest, what are we to make of all of that?
Obviously an ongoing issue, but this past summer it really seems to have escalated. The Coast Guard in Greece just this weekend, past weekend, said that there were 2,500 people that they rescued in the Mediterranean. And we're also seeing kind of more people on this route through the Western Balkans area. Macedonia attempted to shut down their border with Serbia, with this route going through Hungary, and that turned into massive protests, and then the border was stormed, and now into Hungary. Hungary has started to build and is in the process of completing a 175-kilometer wire fence to prevent the refugees from coming in. And as you mentioned, in Budapest, they are now being held at the train stations and not being allowed to go. Their end destination in many cases is Germany, which has taken in a number of these refugees. In fact, Germany and Sweden have taken in more than 50% of the rest of the European Union, which of course is a big issue. They have been more welcoming to these refugees and are now feeling the strains of that. And so Hungary says that it's following laws and to some extent the wishes of the Western countries by trying to get documentation from all of these refugees that are coming in. And when you have these numbers, that's obviously going to take a large amount of processing and of people. But Hungary's taken on a lot of criticism for how they're handling this. The Brits have taken on a lot of criticism as well for how they're handling it. They have been wanting to focus on working with the conflict in the Middle East as opposed to dealing with the immediate situation of these refugees, which, as you say, many of them are coming from Syria, which I'm sure Joshua can speak to. But again, the larger MENA area that many of them are coming through, and just very, very tragic pictures and tragic stories.
The larger issue here is that as the world becomes a more crowded place, there are going to be many more refugees. And what we're seeing as a trickle coming across the Mediterranean is only going to grow larger. And all the developed countries, just like the United States, don't know what to do in the face of this growing flood of refugees.
Well, I think you're right. We're going to see this the pressure continue on this front. Well, thank you, Joshua, Rebecca, as always, for being here. If you have any questions for me or our panelists, feel free to leave a comment on the Worldviews page of KGOU.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, at Suzette Gorlat, and at Joshua_Landis. Coming up next, I'll talk with Chilean author and professor Braulio Fernandez. He's a comparative literary critic whose work juxtaposes Spanish authors with figures like John Donne and William Shakespeare. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat. My guest today is Braulio Fernandez. He's the director of the literature program at the University of the Andes in Santiago, Chile. He earned both a law degree and a PhD in literature from the Pontifical Catholic University in Chile, and is the author of the 2009 book Calderón and Shakespeare that compares Shakespeare's Henry VIII with Pedro Calderón de la Barca's The Schism in England. Braulio Fernandez, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
So, Braulio, you're a professor of literature at the University of the Andes in Santiago, Chile. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you into the field of literature? Why begin to study literature? And I know you're a writer, too. are all literature professors writers, or are we sometimes just studying literature and sometimes writing? Tell me a little bit about the field.
Well, yes. I think that my love for literature began when I learned to read. You know, something goes on me. I get absolutely amazed with this world of letters. I read everything that comes to my hands, butter papers, milk boxes, you know, everything. And I recall one afternoon when my dad came home and he gave me an issue of Robinson Crusoe, an illustrated issue, hardback, and it was absolutely magic. And from that day on, I didn't stop reading till now. So it's very difficult for me to explain that. No, maybe the most close explanation for me is that I found the way to join other worlds with the same admiration that sometimes you find in this real world, a kind of Narnia wardrobe, you know, where you can go there, live adventures, live another life, live another once's life, and then come back to your own real world, but you come back different, renew in some way. So maybe it's a too poetic explanation, but I don't find another one, you know.
Well, I think it's a perfect explanation.
Thank you.
Joining other worlds and literature being magical. That's Braulio Fernandez, a comparative literary critic at the University of the Andes in Santiago, Chile. More of our conversation after a break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I've been speaking with Braulio Fernandez, the Director of the Literature Program at the University of the Andes in Chile. We've been talking about his work comparing Spanish and English classical literature. I mean, you've spent your career focusing on lots of different kinds of literature.
Yeah.
You've done work focused on C.S. Lewis and Shakespeare and T.S. Eliot and Tolkien, yeah. Even. You know, so you obviously have a wide range of interests in literature. But tell us a little bit about maybe Hispanic literature or Latin literature. How do you – I mean, you live in Chile and work in Chile. So make some distinctions for us about literature in that part of the world versus literature in the United States or
maybe,
in Europe.
Maybe, you know – obviously, as I study in a Chilean school, we read there all the tradition of Hispanic American literature, you know, Cervantes, Calderon, all the Latin American writers, pre and post boom. But as I attended a British school and my mother's family is a British family, maybe I think that since I was a little boy, I have a special interest in English literature. Besides, as I told you, we used to read and study all our Hispanic literature tradition. No? What was that because of? Really, again, I don't know. Maybe I found there a way of approaching to the world that for me was different than the way the Spanish writers do. Nevertheless, and obviously I have a deep admiration for Cervantes, for example, and many writers of South America, Borges, Juan Rulfo, obviously Neruda, my countryman.
But when you say a different approach, what do you mean? I mean, how would we understand it if we aren't experts in this area?
I think that languages not only are different sign systems, they don't also be different linguistic articulations, but mostly there are different ways of understanding the world. Just me give you a very obvious example. We in Spanish, for the verb to be, two acceptions. To be is ser o estar. Be is to be and being somewhere, you know. But you in English don't have that distinction. To be is to be and to be in somewhere at the same time.
Same word, different meaning.
Yeah. That's a very simple example. So I think that languages always mean a different way to comprehend the world. I think it is not irrelevant that, for example, there are languages when you have the verb at the end of the phrase, and other languages where you have the verb in the middle of the phrase. So maybe that way of the English language apprehend the world was for me more attractive. I don't know.
Is it just a language thing, you think, or is there some kind of cultural representation
that comes through with that?
It's not just the construction of the language.
Yeah, obviously, it's a cultural
verbs.
Representation. Yeah.
So, how do you get the culture out of it?
Yeah, I went to a British school, so you used to read Shakespeare and Chaucer and John Donne and Keats. All the classes were in English. The headmaster was English. We played rugby. We were beaten as in the English manner, you know. So obviously, my grandfather was English. I used to speak with him in English. Though he wasn't a great lecturer, the literature is part of the culture of a country, no? But and maybe in my case, it was also a sign of rebellion. I think I as everyone was reading Spanish literature or Latin American literature, I feel rebel in having another interesting, you know, something cool, maybe at 16 years old. Well, I'm cool. I'm cool. I read John Donne.
You read Shakespeare.
I read Shakespeare.
How cool can that be, right? Well, so speaking of your work on Shakespeare, you talk about characters in Shakespeare investigating different ways in which freedom is represented.
Yeah, Hamlet particularly.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that.
It's a huge issue, but let me try to summarize. In the context of European literature, and particularly in European theater, what happens in the theater of the 16th and 17th century in Spain and England is that it occurs a great revolution concerning the classical ways of representing, the classical ways of performing, the classical ways of putting over on the scene some traditional characters. This great revolution has to be with putting freedom on the scene. As you can recall, the characteristic of a classical tragedy that you have the myth over the stage, where the will of the gods and the fate of man have a struggle there, you know, and well, everything's know what happens at last, no? The great revolution that writers as Calderón de la Barca, Lope de Vega in Spain, or Marlowe, Shakespeare, Fletcher, Beaumont in England, was to put everyday life over the stage. Not only kings, not only heroes, not only gods, but soldiers, prostitutes, rascals, pickpockets, whatever. Life, real life, with tragedy and comedy all together, and with the spectacle of liberty as the grand theme of those works. So that is what I think Shakespeare became, the invention of the human. I mean, if I understood well Harry Bloom, the invention of the modern human mind, as, for example, Sophocles was the invention of the human in the classical mentality. I think that could be a short explanation of this great revolution. And in Spain as well, you know.
So it's also been said about these works that it has to do with the problems regarding rewriting history. So when you're connecting the project that Shakespeare and others that you've mentioned have about putting everyday life on stage, is this what you mean in terms of like rewriting the way in which we understand life or the way in which we understand history, that we're going to understand it from a different perspective?
No, I think that, as I said, just putting life on the stage. For example, in the case of the histories, I made my PhD thesis in studying a history play of Shakespeare in comparison with Calderón de la Barca. For these playwrights, history is a pretext. They are not historians. They are poets. So history serves them as a raw material. Actually, Shakespeare changes history as his own will, permanently, as Calderón also does. For example, in Calderón's The Schism of England, at last Henry repents himself and calls, crying for Catherine, "Please give me back my wife." That's not historical at all. So for these playwriters, as I told you, history is a raw material. And Shakespeare subverted history many times in King Richard III, in King Henry IV, King Henry V, etc. As many scholars have said, in his histories, Shakespeare told us much about his time than of the time of the plot is historically.
They're taking that historical material
exactly,
and making it relevant
exactly,
for today,
exactly,
huh? Rewriting it in the process.
It's a kind of rewriting of history, but not for historical purposes, but for representation of the, to say it simple, the common struggles of human life, the common challenges, tragedies, problems.
I was going to say, this is like, so the fundamental thing here is whether you're a playwright or a writer of literature, the way in which you use the past to help teach us lessons about today or the future. Well, Braulio, thank you so much for sharing these thoughts with us today and making us all want to go grab a book and read.
Well, thank you very much to you.
Appreciate you being here.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with literary critic Braulio Fernandez from the University of the Andes in Santiago, Chile. There's more information on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaboration between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Sam Dupre put this episode together, and Ivy Dyson prepared our digital content. They're both overseen by our producer, Brian Hardzinski. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Guerlat.